Hey, turn to Mark 16 and turn to John 20 and turn to Matthew 28. Thinking about a men's retreat I was at years and years and years ago. It was my first or second men's retreat, and one of the brothers in a small group discussion was kind of holding forth. You know, some guys just kind of get to going, and he was talking about these sensitive new age guys. You know, they get married and they get all, you know, feminized, and some of them even hyphenate their names. And I kind of looked down at my shoes and said, yeah, I did that once. And he looked at me for, it seemed like 20 minutes. It was probably 30 seconds, but he just stared at me and he said, well, Satan is a deceiver, son. And I, how do you even answer that? Anyway, things you didn't know about your pastor. Anyway, he was right. Satan is a deceiver. I mean, a true story, but also a true observation. Satan is the father of lies. He's the author of confusion, and one of the things Satan loves to get us all twisted up and turned around about is what Jesus thinks about women. Google that phrase, what Jesus thinks about women, and you'll come up with all kinds of stuff. Some of it biblical, some really not. One of the first things that comes up, you know, you get your search results and you get the first page and you click through to another. First page, if you Google that phrase, you'll find an article that headlines, God, the Judeo-Christian God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, holds women in contempt. And another article I clicked on said, well, Christians have to treat women as lesser, inferior beings because they believe the Bible and the Bible tells them that they have to. There's an atheist website that I found called Butterflies and Wheels. Don't ask me why, I don't know. But the authors there call God a bully over and over. That's their favorite word to describe God. And they say Christians, and this is a quote, worship a God who is male, who gangs up with other males against women. And you know, the sad thing is that all of that isn't entirely wrong. About us, I mean. It's completely wrong about God. Could not be more confused about God. But, you know, we can't honestly pretend that some Christian men today and throughout history, we can't pretend that guys haven't perverted God's teaching to elevate themselves and belittle our sisters. It's sad. In fact, it's disgusting, but it's true. And it's also true as a result of that some of our sisters end up belittling and diminishing themselves because, hey, they've had this lie beaten into them verbally, relationally, yes, sometimes physically, that they're inferior. They deserve to be looked down upon. And man, Satan takes that and runs with it, doesn't he? That's why you feel worthless. That's why you can't get rid of your shame, because you are inferior. You have no worth. And so we have all kinds of sisters that are pursuing self-harm and sin and depravity because those things are appropriate for someone who has no worth. All of which is another message or series of messages or a workshop or something. But stay big picture with me this morning. Let's stay at 30,000 feet. We can agree, can't we? That not only out in the world, but even here in the churches in America, church around the world, there's more than a little confusion about what Jesus says about women. And therefore, there's a lot of confusion about what we should think about women and how guys should act to our sisters in Christ. Our text this morning, I think, might shine a little light on that. We're rewinding. We've been on Easter Sunday, the day of the resurrection, for a little while. For all kinds of reasons, we've been taking the events a little out of order. Hopefully when we're done, it all fits together. But we're going to rewind today to early morning. And I don't remember if I asked you to turn there, but Matthew 28, of all the places that I asked you to turn. Matthew 28, verse 2. How does Easter Sunday begin? Resurrection Sunday. Behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat on it. His countenance was like lightning, his clothing white as snow. And the guards that Pilate had set to keep the tomb as safe as they could shook for fear of him and became like dead men. So this is the second earthquake in 3 days. The first earthquake, we talked about this a while ago, at the moment of Christ's death, when he gave up his spirit. The second, I believe, can't prove it, but I think it's a safe inference. I think the second earthquake is the moment of his resurrection. But even before that happened, let's go earlier in the day, even what we would call the evening of the night before, but to the Jews, the day begins the evening before. Mark chapter 1. That's why I had you warm up. And by the way, keep a finger everywhere I told you to go, because we're going to come back to all of them. But Mark 16, when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, James the Lesser, and Salome, who's the mother of James and John, bought spices that they might come and anoint him. So you've got three women who are going to finish the job. They're going to finish preparing the body of Jesus for burial. They had started the evening of the crucifixion, Thursday or Friday, depending upon what you think about that. But they were interrupted because no work could happen after sundown. So that Sabbath tumbles into another Sabbath because High Holy Days, and it runs into Saturday, and we've talked about that. So now it's Saturday night into Sunday morning. They're anxious to finish the job, to wrap the body in spices before it really begins to decay in earnest. So they go shopping for spices. Jewish evening at the end of the Sabbath is sort of like our Thanksgiving is now. Used to be Black Friday, but now once the sun goes down, hey, the stores are open. Same kind of thing in first century Jerusalem. The sun goes down, the Sabbath is over. Hey, the stores are open. We can go buy spices. In verse 2, so very early in the morning on the first day of the week, so Sunday morning, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. All of which reinforces, by the way, they weren't expecting the resurrection. We see this again and again and again. The disciples, no matter how many times Jesus had tried to impress upon them that on the third day he was going to rise again, they didn't get it. Because if they did, they wouldn't be buying spices to prepare his body for burial. If you saw me walking up to the door of the YMCA with my gym bag and my basketball shoes and a basketball, you'd say he's going to play basketball. If I had reason to believe that the Y was closed or that the gym was down for repairs, I wouldn't be carrying any of those things. If I got my basketball gear, I'm going to play basketball. They've got spices. They're expecting to see a dead body. They're expecting to find Jesus' corpse in the grave. What they're wondering is, are they going to be able to get in? Because there's a guard there. There's a seal there across the stone. And then there's the matter of moving the stone, which typically would take 4 military-age males to move. They didn't know God had already taken care of that. God had shaken the earth, which moved the stone, which broke the seal, which scattered the guards. At which point, John chapter 20, at which point Mary Magdalene turns and runs. And I know that we're usually kind of camping out in one gospel here as we study the life of Christ. We usually go to one gospel, that's our play-by-play, and then we grab some verses here and there as we need to for color commentary out of the other gospels. We can't really do that with this story. We really need to toggle back and forth between at least 3 if we're going to understand the chronology of what's happening. But this is going to be fun. This is going to be worth it. It's the glory of kings to seek on a matter. It's the glory of God to reward those who diligently seek him. So go to John 20. Keep a finger everywhere where it's been. But verse 1, first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark, saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So far, so good. Pretty much the same as what we've heard so far. Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved. Who's that? You're with me? Good. And said to them, they've taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they've laid him. Now, some of you are saying, okay, Patrick, you're talking really fast, but you said this is more or less the same? This isn't more or less the same as what we just read. Because what we just read, there were 2 Marys and a Salome. And now there's just 1 Mary. There's just Mary Magdalene. That's not the same. One of these things is not like the other. Except that it's not just Mary Magdalene. Slow down. I'm going fast. I'm really well caffeinated today. But John 20, verse 2, Mary Magdalene ran and came to Simon Peter and to John and said to them, they've taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they've laid him. So Salome and the other Mary are still back at the tomb in all of the gospel accounts. John's just not talking about it because from his perspective, Mary Magdalene came to him. John's writing this in the first person. He's one of the people that Mary came to. And so from his perspective, the story's about Mary. And she says, yeah, we, there were others, they're back there. But John doesn't put that down because it's not in his field of view. So Mary Magdalene is there. And she's saying, grave robbers, they've stolen the body. Oh, these scoundrels have no shame, or words to that effect. Meanwhile, keep a finger here. Go to Mark 16 again. Meanwhile, Mary Magdalene's talking to John and Peter. And Mary Magdalene is saying to John and Peter, you got to freak out because I'm freaking out and we should all be freaking out together. But back in Mark chapter 16, Mary Magdalene's talking, Mark 16, Mary Magdalene's talking to John and Peter. That's off stage now. Mark 16, the scene shifts back. The camera goes back to the other Mary and Salome. And they're getting brave because they're back of the tomb. Mary Magdalene has run off. They're back of the tomb. Should we go in? I think we should go in. We don't know what's in there. We're not going to find out what's in there if we don't go in there. So they actually enter the tomb. In Mark 16, verse 5, entering the tomb, they saw a young man clothed in a long white robe sitting on the right side. And they were alarmed, which we can understand. But he said to them, don't be alarmed. You know when somebody says don't be alarmed, if you weren't already alarmed, that's probably when you get alarmed. But he says, don't be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He's risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him? He's not there. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he's going before you into Galilee. He's not here. He's there. You'll see him there as he said to you. We've talked about this before. I know you forgot. I'm reminding you. And go tell the guys. And that's actually going to be our study next week. We're going to shift the scene and we're going to look at Jesus' ministry up in Galilee after the resurrection. So verse 8, they went out quickly and fled from the tomb, for they trembled and were amazed, which we can understand. And they said nothing to anyone at first because they were afraid. Later, we find out from Luke that they go and tell the apostles. But initially, what just happened? And they take a while to compose themselves. Meanwhile, back in John 20, you know the drill. Keep a finger, we're coming back. But go to John 20. So Mary, mother of James the Lesser, and Salome, mother of James and John, they had to find the disciples. But get the visual here. Two of the disciples, Peter and John, are already on their way to the tomb. Because John 20, verse 3 and 4, Peter went out and the other disciple, and they were going to the tomb. And they ran together, and the other disciple outran Peter, and they got to the tomb. So you've got Mary and Salome going into the city to find the disciples. You've got Peter and John coming out of the city to get to the tomb. Did they pass on the road? I don't know. I do that with Ann at least once a week. I'll be driving north to the house, and she'll come south down hillside to the church, and we'll kind of wave at each other or something like that, or vice versa. So while Mary and Salome are going into town, Peter and John are running to the tomb. And they get there, and John turns to Peter, and he says, I won, because it says there in the gospel. They both ran together, and the other disciple, John, outran Peter and came to the tomb first. John turns to Peter, and he says, I won. Peter says, who's going to know? John says, everyone's going to know. And some people even care. And we shouldn't. Don't let anyone go all spiritual with you on this. Because you'll find people that say, oh, well, Jesus talks about running the race. And Daniel, there's verses about running the race. And Paul talks about running the race. And John is running the race better because he doesn't have that whole denial problem that Peter has. Seriously, people go there. And you really shouldn't. John was younger and faster is what we can infer. It's sort of like, you know, when birds fly south or they fly north, they fly in a V. And almost always one leg of that V is longer than the other. You know why that is, don't you? There's more birds in that longer one. It's John is faster. That's all that's going on here. So verse 5. And he, stooping down and looking in, saw linen cloths lying there. And he didn't go in. Then Simon Peter went in, following him, and went into the tomb. And saw the linen cloths lying there, and the handkerchief that had been around his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded together in a place by itself. Then the other disciple who came to the tomb first went in also, and saw and believed. What did he believe? We're not sure. For as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. And then the disciples went away again to their own homes. So the grave clothes, we find out from other gospel accounts, were undisturbed. It wasn't like you and I throw off the sheets and blankets in the morning, you know, toss the comforter off the bed. No, it's as if Jesus just rose right through the grave clothes. And they don't know what's going on, but they know something's going on. And they know for sure that Mary Magdalene wasn't lying. The tomb was really empty. Something really happened. Did Jesus rise from the dead? They're not ready to go there yet. We see later they're not ready to commit to that explanation. What they know for sure is that the body isn't there. And the inference from this, I think, is interesting, because you and I, we read an account like this and we say, man, I so would want to be with John and Peter, because I'm really sure I'm faster than both of them. But how cool it would be to be able to look at this first person, to see with your own eyes. But what we just read, if you think about it, Peter and John had evidence. They had an empty tomb. They saw the grave clothes and presumably the spices that they had wrapped Jesus up in, because they had started the job. Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea had gotten going. So it's all there, but Jesus isn't there. But they didn't understand fully what had happened. Why? They didn't understand the word. You and I have a better understanding of what happened that night. Why? Because we understand the word, even without evidence, even without being able to look at it with our own eyes, we still have greater faith in events that we didn't witness. I think that's extraordinary. So they believe, or John believes. We don't know what Peter believes, and John just believes that Jesus is gone. He's still processing how Jesus is gone. And they go home because they need to sit and have a think. They need to have a cool drink and try to figure out what's going on. But no sooner have they left, actually we don't know that, but sometime after they left, verse 11, Mary Magdalene shows up. So where has she been all this time? She goes into the city to find Peter and John. They go back to the tomb. Now she's back to the tomb, but she gets there after they leave. So the thing is, in first century Israel, men could run, women weren't supposed to. So Peter and John race to the tomb. Mary walks. So Peter and John are inspecting the tomb. She's making her way there. She gets there, but by the time she gets there, they're gone. They're having their think. But eventually Mary gets there, and when she gets there, it's pretty upsetting. Verse 11, Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping. And as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb, and it was still empty. And then the whole thing's overwhelming because the body's not there. And her friends that she ran all the way to go get, they're not there. And she thought she'd meet them there, and there's no one there who can tell her what's going on. And so she's just sobbing about this. And verse 12, she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet where the body of Jesus had lain. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" You know, she's just pouring out her heart, and they say, "We don't understand. This is a happy day. This isn't a sad day." But she hasn't figured that out yet. She said to them, "Because they've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." Now, when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and didn't know that it was Jesus. She didn't recognize him. Was it because of the tears? She couldn't see clearly? Was it because Jesus was so scarred? Remember, they pulled out his beard? Was she supernaturally blinded? I don't think it's the last one, because he introduces himself almost immediately. He says, "Why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" She thought he was the gardener and said to him, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him and I'll take him away. If you move the body, I don't need to know why. There are no questions asked. Just point me to the body and I'll deal with it." And Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him, "Rabboni," which is to say teacher. It's rabbi, but more formal. And the sheep know the shepherd's voice. She recognizes him. And he said to her, "Don't cling to me, for I've not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father and my God and your God. Don't cling to me." Now that's going to get confusing in a moment. Let me head this off at the pass, because we're going to see other disciples grab hold of Jesus. And if you're reading from the King James or some other older translations, it might say, "Don't touch me." And that's unfortunate, because that's not what's intended here. Cling is a good translation. I think about when my daughter was real little. She loved to come up and just throw herself around my leg, you know, the way that little kids do. And so you're trying to walk with this person on you. And it's fun for a while, and then you realize you're old and you have a bad back. And so I'd say, "Michaela, you know, don't hang on me." And she'd say, well, I just want a hug. Okay, hugging is good. Hugging is fine. We can hug, but don't hang on me. Don't cling to me. And Jesus is saying the same thing to Mary. Hey, it's good to see you too. And we're gonna have more time together. This isn't the only time you're gonna see me. We're gonna be able to talk again. But I've got things to do, and you have ministry to do. Verse 17, Jesus said to her, don't cling to me. I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and tell them what's happened. Tell them you've seen me. Tell them that I've risen. Now, unfortunately, that doesn't go as well as she'd hoped. Verse 18, she goes to the disciples, but we find out from Mark that the disciples didn't believe her. They thought she was delirious. They thought that she was babbling, that she had a fever. So meanwhile, that's what happens with Mary Magdalene when they get separated. What happens to the other women? Matthew 28, meanwhile, they see an angel too. And he says to the women, don't be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He's not here. He's risen, as he said. Sounds familiar, right? Come, see the place where the Lord lay. And they see that he's not there. And now go quickly and tell his disciples that he's risen from the dead and that he's going before you into Galilee. There you're going to see him. Behold, I've told you. And then as they start to make their way in to tell the disciples, Jesus meets them too. Jesus is having a busy day. And he's not done yet because he hasn't even gotten to Cleophas and the other disciple from Emmaus yet. But he appears to them. Verse 9, they went to tell his disciples, behold, Jesus met them saying, rejoice. So they came and they held him by the feet and they worshiped him. And Jesus said, yeah, you don't have to cling to me either. Don't be afraid. Go and tell my brethren to go to Galilee and there they'll see me. He reinforces the message that the angel already gave them. Same kind of thing. Don't cling to me. It's all right. I'm going to go do some stuff and I want you to go do some stuff. Go tell the disciples. I'll meet them in Galilee. And then they don't do that immediately, by the way. Next week, we're going to see Jesus and the disciples in Galilee, but it takes them a while to get there, in part because they're slow to believe that this is really happening. The women have seen them. The women are bought in. The guys take a little longer to come around. And when Salome and Mary, mother of James, try to tell the disciples they've seen Jesus, same reaction that Mary Magdalene got. I think you're hysterical. I think you need to lie down. Do you want a cool cloth for your forehead? And that takes us to Sunday evening, actually, when Jesus appears to the 10. John 20, Jesus shows up right after he has supper with the disciples from Emmaus. And as he shows up, they're talking amongst themselves, and they know that Jesus has appeared to the women. And by this time, he's also appeared to Peter, but no one really knows what to do with that. And so Jesus says, well, let me explain things slowly and clearly so that you'll understand. Now, this is not the only way to sort out the chronology of early Sunday morning. You can find timelines that differ from what I just laid out for you. There are some people who say Mary goes to the tomb three times, once early in the morning, and then she comes back with a group, and then she comes back a third time. There's a variety of other ways of arranging the pieces. I think they all make things more complicated than what I just laid out, and I'm inclined to go with what's the most straightforward. To which you're saying, that was straightforward. If that was straightforward, I don't want the complicated ones. Here's the thing, though. We shouldn't be discouraged when we have to work a little bit to weave things together. In fact, in this particular case, it should be really encouraging to us that we do. Why? If the accounts across the four Gospels, we didn't touch down on Luke, but it's there as well. If the accounts across the four Gospels written by four different guys were identical, if all four of them said exactly the same thing, they saw the same things, they remembered the same things, the same people, the same places, the same chain of events on this emotionally supercharged morning, we'd say, I don't know if I buy it. Back when Pastor Josh and Stephanie were with us, my assistant pastor, before they went back to Calvary of the Ozarks, Josh and I were trying to get to the bottom of a particular situation. And it was this hairy sort of family, mom, dad, kids, he said, she said, and another family, an extended family. And what was interesting is when we got to one of the groups involved, they all said the same thing. Mom, dad, kids, identical story. And we're walking out, and I said, okay, so do you believe them? I mean, they seem credible. And Josh says, I don't know what I believe other than they're all lying. I said, where do you get that? He said, I'm a cop. I'm an investigator. I deal with eyewitness testimony for a living. Nobody's stories line up that well unless they're lying, unless they're hiding something. And of course they were. If Patrick and Josh ever disagree, bet on Josh every time. But the thing is, if the resurrection were a conspiracy, we wouldn't have to work this hard to sort out the timeline. If this was a lie, if this was a fraud, the accounts would be tidy. They'd all line up. The fact that it's a little bit messy, there's no contradictions here. There's no discrepancies. But the fact that it's a little messy, it makes it more believable. It makes the women's story more credible. And the fact that we've got four accounts that all agree that women were the first to see the resurrected Christ, that makes the whole story more credible as well. In fact, it makes it hugely more credible. We talked a little bit about this on Resurrection Sunday. Ever since the resurrection, people have claimed conspiracy. The disciples got together and they hatched this plot to deceive people. That's impossible for a lot of reasons. One of them we just saw. They didn't understand what was happening. They couldn't have launched a conspiracy because the idea of Jesus rising from the dead wasn't something that they'd comprehended yet. So you can't plan to deceive people that Jesus has risen from the dead if the thought hasn't occurred to you. This is the second reason we know it's not a conspiracy. Someone would have talked. You don't die for a lie, and yet 10 of the 11 apostles were martyred, and they tried to kill John, and they just couldn't get it done. They tried to set him on fire, and the flames didn't kill him. You know, if it's a conspiracy, if it's a really, really, really good conspiracy, you might hang in for a long time. You might even hang in through some torture, but by the time they're going to burn you alive or crucify you upside down, you're going to say, it's a lie, it's all a lie. You'll make up a lie at that point to get out of being killed. But no one did that. They all died for the truth of the gospel. And there's a lot of arguments like this, but for this morning, third, the reason I believe the resurrection of Jesus can't be a conspiracy, if you're going to invent a story, if you're going to fabricate a lie, if you're going to try to convince people that Jesus rose from the dead, you don't make women your witnesses. Because in first century Jerusalem, women were property. They weren't people. They weren't proper witnesses. They couldn't testify in court. They wouldn't be viewed as credible. That's not Jesus' view, but that was the prevailing first century Israeli view. What's my point? My point is that if you're mounting a conspiracy and you want the conspiracy, if you want that lie to be believed by as many people as widely as possible, as quickly as possible, you want your witnesses to be as credible and believable as possible. And in that place, in that time, you wouldn't have chosen women. Analogy. All kinds of hearings concerning our president, right? There's tomorrow, I think that there's a hearing, whether they should hold hearings about the last hearing. And they're all asking the same kinds of questions. What did the FBI know? What did the family know? What does the attorney general know? What is Congress saying? What are members of his cabinet remembering? Now, what do all those people have in common? They're high up on the food chain. They've got weight. They've got clout. They've got connections. It's conceivable that they're in the know, and whatever they say is therefore difficult to ignore. Those are credible witnesses. What would happen if someone came forward and said, well, my name is Janie, and I'm in Mrs. Swanson's third grade class, and we were touring the White House, and I heard President Trump tell the secretary to fax the nuclear launch codes to Russia. Okay, we're not calling Janie to the witness stand. No one's taking her deposition. She's in second grade. And I know this sounds incredibly demeaning to women, but this is the point. Mary Magdalene had less credibility in that place in that time than little Janie Swanson in second grade. And Mary was a woman of means. She's ready to write a check for an enormous amount of expensive spices. When she sees Jesus, she thinks he's the gardener. She says, hey, whatever you've done with the body, I'll take care of it. She had the means at her disposal to move a body and get it buried somewhere else. She was a formidable lady, yet she would not have had the weight of a second grade boy in a courtroom proceeding. Even the disciples who knew her weren't ready to believe her, which makes it all the more extraordinary. Jesus appears to women first. And that's not unique. That's not unprecedented. That's Jesus' pattern of treating women in a radically different way than the cultural norms of his time. A revolutionary way. Even secular historians agree on that. Seven things I notice about how Jesus treats women. The first is that he talks to them, and that seems obvious. except he wasn't supposed to. Not at all. Rabbinical literature of the day, one does not speak with women on the street, not even one's wife, and certainly not with one not his wife. Remember the woman at the well in John chapter 4, the Samaritan woman? The disciples are off trying to find lunch, and Jesus is left there, and he strikes up a conversation with a woman who's drawing water, and hey, let me tell you about living water. The disciples come back, and they're freaked, period, out, period. Well, okay, the New King James says that they marveled, but that's my translation. He's talking to a woman. Not he's talking to a Samaritan. Not she's a woman of questionable reputation. He's talking to a girl. Jesus is talking to, we're not supposed to talk to girls. But Jesus did it all the time. The woman caught in adultery in John 8. The widow in Luke 7. The woman with the issue of blood in Luke 8. Woman who called out in Luke 11. Again and again, more examples than that. And if you track them down, Jesus not only spoke to them, but he spoke to them as people, as individuals, not as property. Rabbinical literature, and I'm not going to quote it because it's really, really demeaning, but the rabbinical literature of the day said that women exist for procreation. They can raise children and they can let us have sex without sinning. Flattering, right? And that's the cleaned up version. Jesus says, no. Women don't just exist to perform biological functions like reproduction and child rearing. The closest most people of Jesus' day would get to acknowledging the personhood of a woman would be to say, well, she's so-and-so's wife. She's so-and-so's daughter. So she has some identity in terms of her relationship to a man. You can search the Gospels. Jesus very rarely goes there, and when he does, the relationship with a man is almost always with him. Mary, the mother of Jesus. Okay, I think we'll let that one go. But it's almost the exception that proves the rule. As a rule, women were never referred to as individuals in and of themselves. Jesus shatters that rule. He calls women by their name. He calls them sister. The few times that he does refer interesting to someone in terms of a relationship with someone else, he inverts it. When he talks about Lazarus, he introduces Lazarus or refers to Lazarus as the brother of Mary and Martha. It's the other way around. Just like around here, mostly I'm not Michaela's not my daughter. I'm Michaela's father, because everyone knows Michaela and people have more use for her than me is the point. I can understand that. Second point, Jesus, when he addresses women, which he does often, it's personal, and it's almost always tender. Women are never Jesus' enemy in the Gospels, ever. The woman with the issue of blood, Jesus calls her daughter. And that's not in a condescending way, like if I were, you know, God forbid, to say boy or son to someone. It's a term of affection. It's a term of endearment. And it's a relationship. He's asserting, hey, we have a connection. Woman with the mobility issue, the woman who can't stand up straight in Luke 13. She's bent over. She's in need of healing. He says she's a daughter of Abraham. And so we're brother and sister because we're both descended from Abraham. And that's, I want to come back to that, but just quick side trip. As long as we're talking about the woman with the bad back in Luke 13, he touches her. In healing her, he lays hands on her and touches her. If talking to a woman is bad, you can imagine how bad touching was in that place in that time. Because you're either touching another man's property or you're touching another man's woman, which by definition was touching her sexually because that's all that women were good for. Either way, not good. And Jesus says, yeah, either way, I don't have time for this because it's dumb. There's a person I want to heal. I'm going to touch her. To Jesus, women were always more than property, always more than objects, always more than the focus of sexual lust. And his teaching reflects that. Matthew chapter 5, you don't have to turn there, but you know the verse. If you look on a woman with lust in your heart, you've already committed adultery. If your eye offends you, pluck it out. Better to lose an eye than to burn in hell. What Jesus is saying, next point, women aren't targets. Women aren't targets. He's exhorting guys. The fact that she's dressed provocatively, that's not an excuse. Own your eyes. Own your heart. If you look at a woman, it's not her fault, it's your fault. If a woman is wearing flammable clothes, it doesn't mean that she wants to be lit on fire. Clear condemnation of the objectification of women. Matthew 7, an equally strong condemnation of bullying women. Matthew 7, verse 12, a lot of you have it memorized, it's the golden rule. The golden rule condemns bullying. Why? Do unto others as you would have done unto you. John Piper, in his commentary on this verse, says, can anyone seriously think that Jesus is only talking about men when he tells us to love and serve one another? Does anyone believe that the golden rule is a guy's club? I hope not, at least among us here. Back to Luke 13. Jesus goes out of his way again and again to make sure we don't miss this point. Luke 13, woman hasn't stood up straight in 18 years. Jesus calls her out of the crowd. He says, you want to be healed? She says, do I? In Luke 13, he lays hands on her. Luke 13, 13. Immediately she's made straight, glorified God. The rulers of the synagogue are indignant because he did it on the Sabbath. Verse 15, the Lord said, hypocrite. You've got oxen, you've got cattle, and you lead them around on the Sabbath. You treat your livestock better than your women. Verse 16, ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, think of it, for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath? What he's saying is, hey, leaders of the synagogue, scribes and Pharisees, you get all prideful about being children of Abraham. And when I bring an uncomfortable truth, you say, well, we're sons of Abraham. Guess what? She's a daughter of Abraham. She's as special as you are. She's more special than your ox, but you treat your ox nicer than you treat her. You really need to knock that off. Because if you're Abraham's sons, she's their daughter, and every blessing you claim for yourself is rightly due her. P.S. and by extension, Jesus is also saying that all the blessings that he promises are equal opportunity blessings for men and women. Matthew 5, the meek men and the meek women shall inherit the earth. Matthew 13, men and women shall shine like the sun in the Father's kingdom. Okay, so we've got talk, we've got tender, we've got touched, we've got women aren't targets. We went back to tender for a second. Jesus is also tough. Point number 5, tough on women. How so? Because he tells them when they're in sin. John chapter 4, woman at the well. John chapter 8, the woman caught in adultery. Hang on, I thought that Jesus liked women. How is this a good thing? This is embarrassing. It isn't. Because if you look, Jesus never seeks to humiliate anyone, man or woman. The scribes, the Pharisees, they're trying to humiliate women just so that they can feel superior. Woman caught in adultery, they pulled her out of the bed. Jesus doesn't call out sin with the intention to humiliate. He does it with the intention to liberate. He says to the woman caught in adultery, what? Go and sin no more. He's speaking the truth, but he's doing it in love. No stones in his hands. He calls sin sin, even when it's committed by a woman. And that's respectful. If Jesus didn't respect women, if they didn't have equal standing in his eyes, he'd dismiss it and say, well, she's a woman. She can't help herself. That's condescending. That's how the Talmud describes women. I didn't read it earlier, but the Talmud describes women as pitchers of filth that men run after without control. That's degrading. Well, women are immoral by nature. They just can't help it, and men can't help themselves around them. Jesus says, no, you can't help it. Guys, rein yourselves in. Women, make different choices. You are responsible. But by the way, you can also be forgiven. But go make better choices, because you're a person who gets to make choices. Go make better ones, Jesus says. Go sin no more. Treated women as people, which means being tough when tough is required, when sin is involved. But he didn't just blast them. He teaches. Sixth point. Rabbinical literature of the time said it would be better if the law was burned than if it were delivered to a woman. We don't teach women, the rabbi said. Luke 23, just a few weeks ago, as Jesus is making his way after being tortured, he's been scourged, crown of thorns driven into his scalp. He's making his way to the hill where he's going to be crucified. He teaches women on the way. He gives them a prophecy study. John chapter 11, the story of Jesus and Martha. Same Martha as Mary and Martha, but Mary isn't in this part of the story. John chapter 11. Put eyes there if you want, or just listen, and that's fine too. But John 11, Lazarus has died, Martha's brother. Verse 21, Martha's upset. Lord, if you had been here, you wouldn't have died. Verse 23, Jesus says he's going to rise again. Martha says, well, I know about the resurrection at the last day. Verse 25, Jesus said to her, Jesus teaches her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you're the Christ, the Son of God, who's to come into the world. He not only teaches, he lays one of the seven I am statements of John's gospel on her. A woman gets one of the seven I am statements, the pillars of Jesus' teaching. And not only is he teaching, she's learning. She's reciting it back to him. And listen again, verse 27, I believe you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. Who does that sound like? That sounds like Peter when Jesus says, who do people say that I am? And Peter says, well, they say a lot of things. Peter, who do you say that I am? You're the Christ. She says the same thing, but she says it better. She says it prettier, more eloquently. She's a believer. More than that, she's a disciple. She's a follower. And as a follower, Jesus calls her and others like her, final point, to testify. Go to John chapter 4. We talked about it earlier, the story of the woman at the well. They're going through Samaria. They're making their way north. Jesus' guys are off getting lunch. He's resting by the well. A woman comes to draw water, a Samaritan woman. Jesus talks to her, which she's surprised at. He teaches her, I'm the living water. You drink of me, you'll never thirst again. Her response, you know the story, but remember her response. Verse 28, John chapter 4. The woman then left her water pot, went her way into the city, and said to the men, come see a man who told me all the things that I ever did. Could this be the Christ? And they went out of the city and came to meet him. Who does that sound like? She leaves the water pot behind. The water pot was her occupation. It was her livelihood. That was her gig, hauling water back and forth. Reminds me of some guys who left their boat and their nets behind because Jesus said, come follow me. Reminds me of a guy who left his tax collection franchise behind because Jesus said, follow me. To all of his disciples, Jesus says, leave behind what you have, leave behind what you are, and follow me. This is a woman who's doing that. She's a disciple every bit as much as the guys are. And what's the fruit when she follows Jesus? Go down to verse 39. Many of the Samaritans of the city believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified. John 17, when we continue on in Jesus' high priestly prayer this week, we're going to read Jesus pray almost those same words over the apostles. Two things are equal to the same thing. She is a disciple. Mary Magdalene is a disciple. We'll get there in a moment, but John 4, my favorite thing about John 4 is it comes right after John 3. Okay, you're weird, Patrick, I know. John 3, we've got the story of Nicodemus. John 3 is Nick at night. Nicodemus, who's a Pharisee, who's studied in the law, who's a noble, who already knows about Jesus before he meets him, and he meets with him, and then he believes in him, in secret. Don't tell anyone, I'm undercover. He's a believer. Is he a disciple? I don't think so. He's not following. He's not leaving everything behind. He's not bearing fruit. Not yet. He does later. But the woman at the well, she's never heard of Jesus before. She knows nothing of the word. She's a Samaritan for crying out loud. But he spends some time with her at a well. She follows him openly. She testifies to who he is. People get saved. She's a disciple. And Mary Magdalene, to wrap things up, is a disciple. John chapter 20, verse 17. Jesus says, go tell the disciples, go tell the guys, sister, go testify to them, I'm risen. Jesus' first message, check it out, Jesus' first messenger, the first to testify of the resurrection, the first to say, I've seen the risen Lord, is a woman. And it's not just Mary. It's not just Mary Magdalene who gets to do this. It's not a fluke. It's not a special case. It's not the exception that proves the rule. Other women as well. Mary, mother of James the Lesser, Salome. Go to Matthew 28, and this is where we'll land this morning. Promise? No, but I think so. Matthew 28, the women who aren't Mary Magdalene, they get the same instruction. The angel says, don't be afraid. I know that you seek Jesus who's crucified. He's not here. He's risen. Come look. In verse 7, go quickly. Tell his disciples. Behold, I've told you. So they went out quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to bring his disciples word. And as they went to tell his disciples, Jesus met them. And he said, rejoice and go tell my brethren that I'm risen. Three things. Three things that Mary and the other Mary and Salome that they all have in common. Three things that they're instructed to do. Three things that they're charged with. Believe. Here in Matthew 28, verse 6, the angel reminds them, remember what Jesus promised. Remember what was prophesied. Do you see the empty tomb? Are you putting it together? Believe your eyes. Trust the word. Believe that Jesus is risen. And second thing, rejoice. Verse 8, they were rejoicing. Verse 9, Jesus says, you're doing it right. Keep on rejoicing because there's no better news in the universe. They're called to believe, called to rejoice. Third thing, they're called to share what they've seen and heard. Verse 7 and again in verse 10, go tell the disciples. Don't keep this to yourself. Shout it from the rooftops. So as we wrap up, and we really are, the question I think we're left with, the question I think Jesus leaves us with this morning is not, are women equal to men? I think it's almost the opposite. Men, are we able to rise to the standard that the women are setting for us here? The standard that Jesus is establishing and that the women are exampling. Can we do what they do? And pause, I'm not talking about biology. Yes, men and women are different. And I'm not talking about physiology. Yeah, most men are stronger than most women, and that's just this, what it is. I'm also not talking about leadership, because that's not a function of equality. That's a function of order. My wife and I are equal, yet Jesus has established hierarchy. That's a different conversation. I'm saying, can we guys be the equals of the sisters that Jesus esteems so, so highly? And can we do what they do? Can we do what Jesus told them to do? Can we do what they did, which is go into the world like Mary and the other Mary and Salome, believing and rejoicing and sharing the good news of the risen Christ? Lord, I hope we can. I know we can. By your grace, we can do anything you've called us to do, and you've called us to do this. And so, Lord, we ask as we leave this place this morning, would you meet us with your power? Would you fill us afresh with your Spirit? Would you anoint us and ignite the gifts that you've given us to be your witnesses? And that men, women, teens, young adults, seniors, all of us, Lord, would stand in one accord, pursuing the ministry that you've called us to with diversity of gifts and different experiences and backgrounds and all of the ways that we're different. Lord, would you unite us in the cause of Christ and the love of people in his name.